morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'll try to explain why these things are happening and what it means to you. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through His Torah, which means teaching, not law, and by way of His one and only covenant. If you are rational, this will be the best part of today's program. Our number, should you wish to question, criticize, affirm anything I have to say, or just engage in the conversation, is 877-376-45. I was taken aback, as was my producer, Scott, by the news this morning that not only were eight congressmen, four Democrats and four Republicans, guilty of receiving preferential treatment by a home loan company, that when it came time to investigate the malfeasance and who deserved blame for destroying the U.S. economy, these congressmen altered the subpoena powers so that they themselves could not be investigated and held accountable. What bothers me the most about this is that the American people have been led to believe that it was corporate greed that caused this last recession, when it was, in fact, government malfeasance. Government says they're going to resolve the issue when they have, in fact, made it worse. Government has said that they're going to create jobs and add to the economy when they have, in fact, robbed the economy of jobs. Government says that it's going to impose more regulations on business so that this can never happen again, when in fact all their regulations will do will ensure that it will happen again sooner rather than later, and that the consequences will be more grievous. The reality is that we went into this last recession because the American Congress and administrations couldn't help but try to gerrymander business, get involved in business, so that they could create allegiances to themselves. The decision was made that home ownership was good, therefore home ownership should be underwritten by business. They should make business pay more for loans, make loans harder for businesses to get, so that people could more easily own homes that even they could not afford. And so the rules were changed for consumer lending for homes that gave consumers access to homes, A, with nothing down, B, with adjustable rate mortgages that as soon as the rates went up to reasonable levels, they could no longer afford those homes. And what it did is it created a environment where as soon as the rates went up, as soon as the Fed made money a little bit tighter, people could no longer afford those homes. It was a foregone conclusion that that was going to occur. In fact, it was orchestrated to occur. And when they couldn't afford the homes, they were forced to sell the homes. And when many people are forced to sell at the same time, you destroy the value of the assets. And when the value of the assets were destroyed and people had virtually no equity in those homes, all of a sudden the homes were worth less than they owed on them, and we had a catastrophe. It is exactly how the Great Depression occurred, Gary, although that was in the manipulation here of loans.
Hello.
Well, I can't hear Jerry.
Hi, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Apparently, we're having a hard time finding Craig today, so let's just kind of shoot from the hip. Right. You know, perhaps you can tell the audience here what it is that got you to want to do the movie, and you know, where your ideas come from, how you got those ideas.
Thank you. I had guest hosted once for Craig before, and although he hasn't invited me to guest host today, I'm just supposed to be a guest, I'll be happy to host until you find him. I'm not going to say that Craig's the prodigal son that's lost and we're trying to find him, similar to what we had in our movie, but we are doing a movie that's a modern day retelling of the prodigal son, and essentially he asks for his inheritance early. His father shocks him and his older brother by saying, okay, I'll give it to you. He gets his millions of dollars. He takes off, leaves the farm, goes to the big city, learns some lessons, and comes back a humble and better man. As for our regular host here, I'm sure he's going to come back just fine. There's probably some technical glitch there, like a flat tire or maybe something.
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. Probably just a technical glitch or something like that. But go ahead, Jerry.
Well, first of all, if anybody is interested in being an extra in the film, it's in Raleigh, North Carolina. We kind of affectionately dubbed our name of our town Raleighwood, because our state has a big incentive for people making films here. The Hunger Games were made here, and they got like $20 million rebate or something for making it here. We're getting a sizable rebate for making ours here instead of in California. But they would go to Facebook.com, and once they get there, just enter in the name of our film, which is called A Long Way Off, right from Luke 15 on the prodigal son. While the son was a long way off, the father saw him and ran to him. So you put in A Long Way Off casting, and you go to that page, and it'll just click like on it, or you're on a mailing list, and we'll let you know which days we have which scenes and who's able to do it. So if anybody feels like driving into Raleigh or flying into Raleigh, we're doing it for the next 3 weeks, starting Sunday, and it'll be a lot of fun. Robert Davi, who is in James Bond, Die Hard, Goonies, et cetera, about 100 films. He's going to be one of the actors there. Edie McClure.
Incidentally, I always felt like Robert Davi was he's just a strong character. He's a guy that says a lot without saying anything at all.
Right. He's usually one of two roles, either the tough guy lieutenant on the police force, whatever, or more often than not, the bad guy.
Usually. But I've seen him play a good guy. He can play either role. Effectively.
You know, one thing that Craig did want to talk about today was his chapter in his book called Metaneo. It's spelled M-E-T-A-N-O-E-O at yadaya.com. It's Y-A-D-A-Y-A-H.com. And what the word means is it means changing your thinking and direction. And that's, I consulted with Craig while we were in the initial stages of making this film about the prodigal son. And Craig's a funny guy. I asked him to help me a little bit with it. So instead of helping me with my one or two pages of questions, what he did was he rewrote his entire chapter on the prodigal son at Yada Yah. And I casually asked him afterwards, how much time did he put into this? And he says, 20 hours. So I know that he put a lot of time into it, and it was important to him. So I did want to talk a little bit about his chapter, which I have opened up before me here. It opens by saying this is a prophetic picture the prophets have painted, that Yehudim would abandon their God, that's how the people call them, the Jewish people, reject their covenant and give birth to devilish doctrines. Two millennia separate the time they shunned Yahusha and eventual unification with Yahweh. This 2,000 timeout period is nearly over. And so in real life, what Craig, who calls himself Yada, would be teaching would be that essentially, even though a lot of people have a myth, which he shatters often, that no man knows the day or the hour of the return of Messiah, in reality, the holiday actually is called No Man Knows the Day or the Hour. When you talk about the fall feast, you're talking about one of them. You got Yom Kippurim, and then you also have Feast of Trumpets. Well, Feast of Trumpets is like the rapture, or technically the harvest would be the more accurate way of putting it. And the one after that is Yom Kippur, which is the return of our Savior. So the Jews for years used to call one of those holidays No Man Knows
Teruah,
the Day or the Hour.
They called Teruah, the Unknown Day, which you're calling Trumpets.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I'll let you explain it. And if indeed it is unknown, then we more or less, we know what holiday it'll happen on, what feast it'll happen on. We just don't know what particular year, and I believe...
We don't know what hour or year, but we certainly do know that it occurs on Teruah. Teruah means, to shout for joy. It also means sound an alarm.
What are the other names to Teruah that people might be more familiar with?
Trumpets. The other one would be trumpets.
The blowing the ram's horn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's actually called trumpets.
Now, I know he has told me before he believes...
Well, it's been replaced. Now, it no longer, I guess, the name that most people would use today, and, of course, then it changes the character. It's like changing Yahweh to Lord. In the religious Jewish calendar...
Oh, Rosh Hashanah, you mean?
Teruah no longer plays a part. It's called Rosh Hashanah.
Oh, the new year. Yeah, right.
So it's become the Babylonian head of year, and it's about blowing the horn and confusing Satan so he can't... can't find you if you're a Jew. Of course, that makes no sense.
Now, what year do you think that would be? I think Craig has told me before he thinks like most likely 2026, but possibly as early as 2023. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think that he will allow us to go as close to the fire as possible without getting us in the fire.
And what's
so
the very last
Craig's
year that
right.
could be?
I mean, it's not Yahweh's character to watch his family suffer. And if we go back to Yahshayahu, what he tells us is that, better known as Isaiah these days, what he tells us is that women and men that are seen with the proper attitude are collected. And in other words, these are people that they understand Yahweh's character. They're part of the covenant. They're part of the family. They don't need to go through 7 years of torture because, you know, the only reason that 7 year tribulation is there is to wake people up. You know, if you're already awake, there's no need for you to, you know, get up, hit upside the head with a brick bat. Right.
Yeah, Larry, I think there's actually another reason that the 7 years exists. I think it really just is the culmination of man's bad choices and that we bring it upon ourselves. The prophecies regarding it are designed so that when these things deteriorate and begin to happen, those who are at least open to an explanation will find that explanation. If you find a precise prediction written between $2,000 and $3,000 to $4,000 in advance of what you're observing, you're going to have a tendency, at least if you're open-minded and willing to investigate the evidence, to say, all right, now I understand what's happening, why it's happening, what can I do to save myself from this calamity? And so I think the prophecies exist for the reason you stated, but I think the events themselves during the last 7 years transpire because we humans have made and will continue to make a whole lot of bad decisions.
Well, let's formally introduce Yada. Welcome to your own show. You came in like a thief in the night, kind of slid into the show. You remind me of the Great Gatsby. You decided to attend your own party.
Just before the end of the first segment, we'll talk about the technical glitch that occurred here. But it's my pleasure to be part of the Shattering Myth show. Thank you guys for filling in. We'll be back after the break. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. I apologize for the rough start, but I'm glad that Larry and Jerry were able to go in my stead. My little cranky technology this morning. I was here, but I was listening to an entirely different program. You guys were talking about something that's actually related to the story of the prodigal son, because the story of the prodigal son is about is literally speaks of a harvest. It's a harvest of one, but the harvest of one is indicative of others, those who are reaped from the many, gleaned, if you will, from the many. And well, everything Larry said regarding teruah, trumpets, being the day that this harvest will occur, and what you even said about Yah's likely to wait to the very last minute. The one thing I would like to add to that before we move on to the story of the prodigal son is that while the most likely date would be teruah in 2026, because the tribulation begins in fall of 2026, so that it can end on the day of reconciliations in year 6000 Yah, which is 2033. So 2026 is the last possible time, which would be consistent with Larry's analysis that God's going to keep us engaged in this spiritual battle to save as many souls as possible before those who remain have to endure the tribulation. There is also an issue of just overall timing, and that is that God wants his return, and you can assure, you can put your clock to it, check your calendar, Yah's return is going to be exactly on the Day of Reconciliations in year 6000 Yah. And so all of the events that he predicted have to culminate on that today. And so if by removing us a little bit earlier or a little bit later facilitates that timing, that's what he's going to do. And so there aren't a lot of people who listen to what God has to say or who are influenced about us trying to communicate what God has to say, and Jerry knows that because that is his business, is booking hosts on media outlets that communicate messages. There isn't much demand for a message that condemns religion and politics and patriotism by presenting Yah's testimony against these things, nor any demand for someone who is going to present the Torah literally and how it should be observed so as to encourage people to participate in the covenant. To the degree that we do have a voice, and there are those who listen, and there are thousands who do listen, then they have an influence on our world. And I think Yah's timing on our withdrawal will coincide with what's ideal for everything to end up with his return, ending the Battle of Armageddon on October 2nd, 2033, 6:22 p.m., using our pagan way of reckoning. Is that consistent with what you have come to know or conclude, Larry?
Yes, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, and there is a specific tie-in to the actual name of the day, Teruah. Teruah does speak of a ram's horn. It's a shofar. Important messages were announced using this shofar. There's a number of references in the Olivet Discourse to the shofars being blown when Yahweh returns. And so he is the message, he is the messenger, and so you would expect a shofar trumpet to be blown. And although he is not going to arrive on earth, he is coming to harvest his children, to collect his children to him during this time, and it is going to send a very powerful message to the world. And it is that message where a considerable number of people are going to say, now, what's just happened here? Is there an explanation for this? And while most will turn to all sorts of odd justifications, I have no doubt that even the Mayan prophecies and Nostradamus will be consulted here. There will be a number who turn to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and will find this event predicted therein. So I do think that it will send a tremendous message. What I'd like to do today, this is the thing that we wanted to do on our show on Wednesday and got somewhat into it, but I'd like to share what we know of the story of the prodigal son, share at least what is recorded of Yosha's story, and then talk about it. So I'm going to read the statements that Yosha makes, maybe add a comment or two, and then would like you guys to discuss it. And the reason we are focusing on the prodigal son is because Jerry, of special guest Jerry McLaughlin, has written a screenplay and is now producing a movie called A Long Way Off, about a modern reenactment of the great story of the prodigal son. When we return, that's where we'll begin. I am Yada. This is The Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. We're reviewing the story of the prodigal son because Jerry McLaughlin, a good friend of mine, the president of Special Guests, and now the producers of a film called A Long Way Off, is beginning to film a score that they have written that is specifically designed to bring the story of the prodigal son both forward in time and back in time. Forward in time to set it in a modern setting with characters who are credible today, and back in time because the story of the prodigal son is the story of the covenant. It's the story of where Abraham represents the Father, and of course Abraham represents our Heavenly Father in the story of the covenant. So while the story does not actually begin with these words, this is the the place most people began. The story actually, as you guys know from our show on Wednesday, begins with a number of examples that Yahusha made so that the whole story was set into context. Yahusha went so far, Yahusha, as to identify the son that had the tizzy fit when his brother returned, identifying that son with the rabbis and the scribes who thought they were holier than thou. So the story begins, and he said, this is Yosham, a certain individual had two sons. The younger of them said to the father, "Father, give me the part of the estate offered to me." So he divided its life. That's interesting. The last word there is actually life. It is bios, which is the means to which life is sustained. So rather than using a standard word, so he gave him some money, so he gave him some something tangible, so he gave him some property, the actual word that Yosha must have used is che, which is the Hebrew word for life, because the inheritance of the covenant isn't money. And so for this to be representative of the covenant, the inheritance needs to be life. Because what is the inheritance of the covenant? It is living forever with Yahweh. So that's the first statement. What do you think the reasons may have been for the choice of, so he divided its life? And what do you think the identity of the two sons are in this story, Jerry? Larry?
Well, the prodigal son himself represents most all of us, because we really have gone wayward, whether we've ever had a relationship with our father, creator, or not. We have gone wayward in varying degrees, and when we finally do a 180-degree turn, and that's what it is, really. It's literally a 180-degree turn in our film. He goes the opposite way. He takes off from his father's farm homestead to the city, learns his lessons, then finally comes back directly again, a very humbled man. So, yeah, I would think he would definitely represent the
children of the covenant. Yeah, it would be any child that returns to Yah represents those of us who have chosen to take Yahweh's advice seriously and have embraced the terms and conditions of the covenant and returned home. So, Jerry, you and I don't think it has to do, anything to do with race. I really don't. I think that the son who returns home just represents children of the covenant, regardless of whether they are Yehudim or Goyim. I don't think there's a racial implication there. I think it's any child of the covenant that has wandered away from God by having indulged in human schemes and participated in human schemes and has chosen now to come home. So there may be as many as 1,000 of us alive today that represent the returning son. The elders.
You know, in addition to that, what you pointed out is life. I was having this debate today with a guy who was telling me he was commanded and he was obedient. And I said, "Well, how do you keep the tithe?" He said, "Easy." And he went to Deuteronomy, and you know, when they couldn't carry it, it was too long of a draft, they could convert it to money. And he says, so he converts his agricultural business to money, sets the money aside until he's one day going to be told where to give it. And I said, "Well, the tithe itself has to be food; it can't be money." And you're talking about life, and there it is. You know, their money will be worthless in the covenant. Worthless.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things, too, that's interesting is that it was not too long ago, I was in the, amongst the project of trying to edit Yada Yah. And one of the things that I learned as I was trying to deal with a passage that was associated with Shavuah. Shavuah is the festival feast, the invitation to meet with Yahweh that precedes Teruah, which was the one that you all were talking about at the beginning of the show. And it speaks there of a tithe. And so I was compelled to figure out, what does this word actually mean? And come to find out, the word describes the very purpose of the day that Shavua represents, the promise of the covenant, the promise of sevens, which is what Shavua represents. It's not a donation of a tenth part at all. It's that which enriches and enlightens and empowers. Is what the basis of the word means. And so what God is speaking of is enriching us, empowering us, enlightening us, and that is the stuff of life. Because there is more to life than simply being alive. And it was my eldest son that alerted me to this a number of years ago. That which does not grow dies. And so for God to live and be eternal, God must grow. And for us to be immortal, we must grow. And the way God enables us to grow is he enriches us, he enlightens us, he empowers us so that we grow. So this life, this bios, is more than just having an ongoing consciousness. It is all about the inheritance that comes from being alive. And what it means to grow through continued life. So we are now have a pretty good idea as to who the returning son was in the story of the prodigal son. What the youngest son represents. The eldest son is a challenge because of the way that the text is written. It is a challenge both. No matter how you try to interpret it, in fact, in the Christian interpretation, the way that the words read now doesn't work at all. You know, the Christian interpretation, the youngest son represents the Gentile church, and the oldest son is the religious Jews having a tizzy fit. But the comment that, of course, Yosha makes, that at least as it's now recorded in Greek, is he says, you know, you've always been with me. Well, the words mean that you were with me and you will be with me. And so long as we recognize that it is the descendants of Abraham, of Yishak and Jacob, that were the original children of the covenant and will return again to becoming the children of the covenant, although they are not now, they are currently estranged in mass, then the statement makes sense of the reason that the eldest son was having a tizzy fit is that he represents those religious Jews and secular Jews who are in the midst of a timeout for bad behavior, one that has not been eternal, one that did not begin estranged but became estranged, and one that will not stay estranged because the Yah's return on the Day of Reconciliations reconciles that relationship.
Well, it's hard to get away from the definition of the oldest son's name. I mean, it means presbyteros. Am I pronouncing that right? It means higher-ranking elder son. So higher-ranking, you know, if my name was, say, hi, my name's higher-ranking. What's your name? I might be a little prideful myself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
did I get that word correctly?
Yeah, you did. But we also have to be careful in this regard in that Yosha did not tell that story using that name. He did not speak Greek. He told the story in Hebrew to a Hebrew audience. And so when we ascribe a name as if that were reliable, we have to be really careful because this was written in Luke. Luke was not an eyewitness. It was spoken in Hebrew. And now the testimony we have of it has been translated. And so we have to be careful in that regard.
Well, wasn't Yosha using a little bit of a sense of humor with that word, though?
Well, I don't think so, because he didn't use that word.
Well, you wrote on page 11 or 12, I remember, of this chapter. Here, let me read it. I found it here. The use of presbyteros demonstrates Yosha's sense of humor. The scribes, especially those who comprised the Sanhedrin, referred to themselves as the presbyteros / elders. There would have been no doubt in the scribes and the Pharisees' minds that Yahusha was talking about them. That's how you open that section.
And I'm aware that that was the statement, and what I'm telling you is that while he would have spoken Hebrew and the term that he would have used in Hebrew to describe the hierarchical nature of the scribes and the Pharisees and their view that they stood above the people, kind of like the hierarchical nature of Roman Catholicism today, they would have understood the reference. But he didn't actually use Greek. He didn't speak to them in Greek. He spoke to them in Hebrew. And so part of the legacy here is that as you you write and you learn and then you go back and edit, I am now finding myself, anytime I'm focused on something, to constantly reinforce the reader's attention to the realization that when we're reading Greek, we're not reading what was actually said. So if I were to focus on that again, I would still emphasize the connection to the religious community in terms of the scribes considered themselves above, superior to the average individual. That's why they were part of the Sanhedrin. They were the judges. They were the rulers. They were the political types. But the connection can only be made when you translate the Greek back into to Hebrew and then hear those words from the perspective of the Hebrew audience that they were spoken to. The next statement, as it's recorded in Greek in Luke, now translated in English, says, "A few days later, the younger son gathered everything and went on a long journey to a distant land where he scattered and squandered what he possessed with unrestrained indulgence and licentious living."
With whores, or the word is porne, C-O-R-N-A-Y, symbolic of temple prostitutes and perverted fertility cult with the whore of Babylon, that later on, you know, the so-called righteous ones actually were cavorting with as well 2,000 years ago.
Yes, in fact, we're going to return to this particular statement because there is so much subtlety in what God is trying to convey to us that it's worth examining even closer. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
You know what?
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We were just reading the line from, as it's recorded in Greek, translated now into English from Luke, where it says, "A few days later, the young son gathered everything and went on a long journey." Now, a few days is specific. When you look at the history of Yehudim, they began in a relationship with Yah, and they did not leave that relationship immediately. But as time transpired, they did. And 3 days, a few days, 3 days is very significant. The means to reconcile the relationship between God and the children of Israel took place over 3 days. Those 3 days being Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. And it speaks here now, the younger son gathered everything. So he took everything that he was given and went on a long journey to a distant land. So it's not that he just went next door. It's not that the Jews took a slight detour from the instructions that Yah had provided in his Torah. They went in the opposite direction, and they went a long way away. There is almost no connection now between Judaism and Yah's Torah teaching. And so they have gone a long way away and to a very distant land and have been estranged from what they were given. And he scattered and squandered that which he possessed. When God speaks of calling us home and of the blessings of the covenant, he very often uses terms, particularly when we investigate the Hebrew, that speak of us foolishly squandering the gifts of the covenant, the gift of life, the gifts of perfection, the gift of being adopted. And that squandering is kind of manifest, I think, when we look at what happens if we die estranged from God. Our lives are just snuffed out. We squandered our lives. We squandered free will. We squandered the gift of conscience. And so it speaks of that we're just squandering it. And then it said that he did so in unrestrained indulgence and licentious living, choosing to replace, trying to satiate, if you will, the cravings that he had and was unable to do so. You know, it's the drug addict can never get enough. The sex addict can never get enough. Those who covet money never seem satisfied. When it comes, if that is your goal, if that is what pleases you, you will never find pleasure. Very indicative of human nature. Then the next statement is, but when he had wasted it all, there was a significant scarcity in the harvest in that land, and his rule began to fail, leaving him powerless and destitute. So it sounds like for a while that he may have had some temporary transitional success, but that when things turned south, what he was relying on turned unreliable, and he was sucked into it. It's kind of like you look at the history of America. America has received, has accomplished many things, but now that there is a scarcity in the harvest, our economy is faltering, everything is failing around us, and the people who have become dependent on government are going to feel powerless and destitute as they realize that human institutions, political and religious, aren't reliable. And I think that's part of what's being conveyed here. What about you guys?
Well, I think that what he's saying here is clearly he's no longer putting his trust and reliance in the path, in the covenant. He's off on his own, and he's eating poison. I mean, he's living among the dead.
Yeah, we all have this desire to be loved. We all have this desire to feel secure. And rather than receiving love through the covenant, rather than receiving security through Yahweh, he looked at man's means. You know, the military provides our freedom and our security, and the our government provides for our basic human needs and rights. And
yeah,
he was off. Yeah, he was off trying to find love and comfort in all the wrong places,
well,
and found them wanting.
Found love and comfort in two ladies. One of them, Jezzy, the Laura / Jezzy. He gives them, you know, what his material cravings are, but he comes around later and realizes that wasn't fulfilling. And he had another gal there that was more of a good influence on him, and he had to, you know, make a decision to export. By the way, our web address for this film is alongwayoffthemovie.com, alongwayoffthemovie.com. No dashes or anything.
In a moment. This is Shattering Myths.
I had tried everything. I'd cut back the amount of food I was eating. I was lifting weights and jogging, but nothing was working. My body was literally starving for minerals and trace elements.